This is Medieval Death Trip for Saturday, August 30th, 2025, episode 116, concerning the near-death visions of Fursa and Drichthelm. Hello and welcome to Medieval Death Trip, the show where we explore the wit and weirdness of medieval texts. I'm your host, Patrick Lane. Today, we round off a summer of wondrous travels with a couple of visits to the afterlife, hearing two rather famous accounts of people who seemingly died, went to the great beyond, and then returned to the land of the living with stories to tell of infernal torments and heavenly delights. In other words, near-death experiences. A phenomenon still experienced today. In fact, more frequently experienced today than in centuries past due to improved resuscitation methods. And it is a distinct phenomenon. A near-death experience is not the same thing as an otherworld journey, though there may be overlap in features. Near-death experience has a clinical description, or at least quasi-clinical, much like sleep paralysis does, where there is a recognized constellation of common features to the experience and an underlying definable physiological process, even if the cause and effect relationships between the physical process and the perceived experience are not all that well understood. But that physiological element, a process that should, generally speaking, have the same core qualities for all human beings who experience it, makes near-death experiences a productive node for doing some cross-cultural, trans-historical comparisons. We'll come back to that after the texts. But first, let's define what we mean by near-death experience. For quite a bit of this discussion, I want to acknowledge a source, a very good 2024 article from The Guardian by Alex Blasdell, which you can find links to in the show description and on our website, medievaldeathtrip.com. But a lot of my info also comes from my own lifetime of reading about paranormal phenomena. Anyway, the first key point to highlight is the adjective near. These are not, necessarily, death experiences. It doesn't mean the experiences of people who have come back from being dead. More accurately, we can say that people have come back from the experience of dying to report what it was like. Whether or not we have any genuine testimony of the experience of death itself is a far more questionable proposition. What we do have are near-death experiences, as reported by people who in most cases have suffered cardiac arrest and been resuscitated. Sometimes kind of a big deal is being made about such people being declared clinically dead, either on the operating table or in an ambulance. But clinically dead doesn't really mean dead in the way most of us would use the word. Clinically dead means that respiration and circulation have stopped. The person isn't breathing and their heart isn't beating. Their body is no longer carrying out the essential functions necessary to maintain life. But their cells aren't dead yet. Their brain isn't dead yet. Death in both of those cases meaning that metabolic processes within the cells have ceased. Hence, people revived from being clinically dead are considered to have had experiences of near-death states rather than death states. And this modern nuance is actually anticipated in medieval conceptions of death, which were not as neatly binary between being alive and being dead, as we might think, but allowed for some middle states between the two, as we've talked about in earlier episodes, and as we'll talk about again shortly. Now, I'm not trying to throw water on anyone who has the killer conversational icebreaker of, I was clinically dead for 3 minutes. That is still a big deal. One of the great misconceptions bred by movies and TV shows is that CPR is very effective. If you start it soon and keep it up, you can save just about anybody. Certainly, everybody should learn CPR. It is a great thing. But it's rather disheartening to learn that when administered outside of a hospital, only between 5 and 10% of CPR attempts are successful in bringing the patient out of cardiac arrest, even here in the 21st century. In hospitals, outcomes are better, but still, only somewhere between 20 and 40% succeed. So, while we might quibble over just how dead someone in cardiac arrest is at that moment, it is also true to say that to survive cardiac arrest is absolutely to survive a brush with death, to really beat the odds. And anywhere from 10 to 20% of the lucky few who have been resuscitated from cardiac arrest report some degree of near-death experience. So within that small population of survivors, it's not that uncommon of an experience. And what is that experience? Well, the reason it's fruitful for cross-cultural comparison is because it does appear to have this rather narrow set of repeated features. It's been recorded in many different cultures and religions, and while there is a great variety in specific narrative details, there are also these recurring motifs that appear across cultures, such as the sensation of being outside or above of one's own body, sometimes looking back at it, a feeling of traveling to a different place, sometimes through a tunnel of light or darkness, encountering another conscious agent in that place, sometimes a dead relative or friend, or a guide figure. And a reliving or observing of earlier experiences, perhaps in a survey of moments in one's own life, or sometimes moments from past lives or incarnations. And here we hit the central sticking point in explaining this universality, which goes right to the core of what the near-death experience is. Are these experiences so similar because they are produced by the same biological process of the brain shutting down? Or are they the same because they are the reality of what happens when the soul leaves the body? Both positions involve assumptions about how the universe works, and whichever assumption you start from, you are likely to upset those holding the other assumption. Indeed, a certain stigma still surrounds the academic study of near-death experiences, partly because some of the loudest voices on the subject are parapsychologists and believers who do try to use these experiences to argue for scientific proof of life after death. So physicians and cognitive scientists investigating the phenomenon have to deal with resistance and critique from believers who see their convictions and religion being brushed aside by callous scientists thought to be out to debunk religious belief, and who are telling individuals who had what they may feel is a profoundly meaningful experience that it was just brain chemistry, essentially a hallucination. And it's hard not to look a bit like a bully when you're doing that. And at the same time, some other academics view any investigation of the topic as potentially a covert effort to validate religious belief, so researchers in the field have to deal with hostility and suspicion from both sides. Against charges of materialist bullying, there is, of course, always the agnostic escape hatch. Maybe near-death experiences are a product of natural biology, like dreams or visions induced by psychoactive substances, but who's to say that the supernatural doesn't communicate meaning to us mere mortals through a biological process? Well, the Vatican authorities responsible for authenticating miracles in the canonization process would care quite a bit about that distinction, actually, since for something to qualify as a miracle, it cannot have a plausible materialist explanation. But luckily, we aren't talking about miracles, we're talking about near-death experiences, which in a medieval context fall under the umbrella of visions. Well, mostly. There is often a miraculous element of resurrection involved, where someone who has been regarded by witnesses as dead comes back to life and then relates a vision. But even here, interestingly, lots of writers of these narratives tend not to overemphasize the so-and-so was brought back from the dead part of the story. Like, it's part of the story, but rare is the author who waxes on about the awesome power of God to bring the dead back to life. Maybe that's because, as I mentioned earlier, the Middle Ages acknowledged a kind of spectrum of death, where there's someone in extreme illness, then there's someone who shows no signs of life, and finally there's a rotting corpse. And in that in-between phase, there's a reasonable reticence to definitively say someone is dead. Also, as we'll see, quite a few medieval near-death, out-of-body visions are specifically identified as occurring in the extremes of illness, but not actually through death. Muddying the water further, some medieval theology recognized a distinction between the eternal soul and the animal spirit that gave the body life, and it could be possible for the soul to have an out-of-body experience while the animal spirit kept the heart pumping and the lungs breathing. So, whether a tour of the afterlife is a mere vision granted to the person like a dream, or whether it's the eyewitness testimony of a disembodied soul, is not always clear in these accounts. The two narratives we'll hear today both come from the Venerable Bede's Historia Ecclesiastica Gentis Anglorum. The first involves St. Fursa, as he is generally referred to by scholars today, also known as St. Fursey, which is the more popular anglicization and is indeed the form used by our translator for the Latin Fursius. But I'll go with the scholarly consensus and say Fursa here in the commentary. Fursa was active in early 7th century Ireland, from which he led a mission to East Anglia in the 630s, which is what brings him to Bede's attention as a historian of the English Church, writing about 100 years later. Fursa's legends ascribe to him a reputation for sanctity and wonderworking, the most extreme instance crediting him with raising from the dead a pair of noble children. Bede does not touch on this. In fact, a thing to listen for is what, according to Bede, makes Fursa such a good missionary. Spoiler alert, there is no wonder-working and no miracles. Or almost. He mentions some posthumous miracles, and he does record a set of visions Fursa had while extremely sick. And these do come with a lightly miraculous token of proof. Though even here, Bede emphasizes that Fursa kept these visions mostly private and only shared them with a select few honored associates. Fortunately for us, Bede does not share Fursa's reticence to reveal these secrets and has passed the visions on to us. So, here are the visions of St. Fursa from Book 3, Chapter 19 of Bede's Historia Ecclesiastica, as translated by J.A. Giles. One quick note, Giles translates the Latin Scotia as Scotland and Scottish. As we learned back in Episode 48, in Bede's time, Scotia typically referred to Ireland. We might more accurately translate it as Celtic rather than specifically Irish or Scottish. And even within this excerpt, Bede rather confusingly also uses the Latin Hibernia to specifically refer to Ireland, Fursa's birthplace, but later calls him of noble Scotic blood from Scotia. I'm preserving Giles' choice to render this as Scottish and Scotland, but just know that Bede means Irish and Ireland in both cases. And with that out of the way, now here are the visions of St. Fursa. While Sigbert still governed the kingdom, there came out of Ireland a holy man called Fursey, renowned both for his words and actions, and remarkable for singular virtues, being desirous to live a stranger for our Lord wherever an opportunity should offer. On coming into the province of the East Saxons, he was honorably received by the aforesaid king, and performing his usual employment of preaching the gospel, by the example of his virtue and the efficacy of his discourse, converted many unbelievers to Christ, and confirmed in his faith and love those that already believed. Here he fell into some infirmity of body, and was thought worthy to see a vision from God, in which he was admonished diligently to proceed in the ministry of the word which he had undertaken, and indefatigably to continue his usual watching and prayers, inasmuch as his end was certain, but the hour of it would be uncertain, according to the saying of our Lord, "Watch ye therefore, because ye know not the day nor the hour." Being confirmed by this vision, he applied himself with all speed to build a monastery on the ground which had been given him by King Sigbert, and to establish regular discipline therein. This monastery was pleasantly situated in the woods, and with the sea not far off. It was built within the area of a castle, which in the English language is called Knabhersburg, that is, Knabber's town. Afterwards, Anna, king of that province, and the nobility, embellished it with more stately buildings and donations. This man, Fursey, was of noble Scottish blood, but much more noble in mind than in birth. From his boyish years, he had particularly applied himself to reading sacred books and following monastic discipline, and, as is most becoming holy men, he carefully practiced all that he learned was to be done. In short, he built himself the monastery wherein he might with more freedom indulge his heavenly studies. There, falling sick, as the book about his life informs us, he fell into a trance, and quitting his body from the evening till the cock crow, he was found worthy to behold the choirs of angels and to hear the praises which are sung in heaven. He was wont to declare that, among other things, he distinctly heard this: "The saints shall advance from one virtue to another." And again, "The God of gods shall be seen in Zion." Being restored to his body at that time, and again taken from it 3 days after, he not only saw the greater joys of the blessed, but also extraordinary combats of evil spirits, who by frequent accusations wickedly endeavored to obstruct his journey to heaven. But the angels protecting him, all their endeavors were in vain. Concerning which particulars, if anyone desires to be more fully informed, that is, with what subtle fraud the devils represented both his actions and superfluous words, and even his thoughts, as if they had been written down in a book, and what pleasing or disagreeable things he was informed of by the angels and saints, or just men who appeared to him among the angels, let him read the little book of his life which I have mentioned, and I believe he will thereby reap much spiritual profit. But there is one thing among the rest which we have thought may be beneficial to many if inserted in this history. When he had been lifted up on high, he was ordered by the angels that conducted him to look back upon the world, upon which, casting his eyes downward, he saw, as it were, a dark and obscure valley underneath him. He also saw four fires in the air, not far distant from each other. Then asking the angels what those fires were, he was told they were the fires which would kindle and consume the world. One of them was of falsehood, when we do not fulfill that which we have promised in baptism, to renounce the devil and all his works. The next, of covetousness, when we prefer the riches of the world to the love of heavenly things. The third, of discord, when we make no difficulty to offend the minds of our neighbors, even in needless things. The fourth, of iniquity, when we look upon it as no crime to rob and to defraud the weak. These fires, increasing by degrees, extended so as to meet one another, and being joined, became an immense flame. When it drew near, fearing for himself, he said to the angel, "Lord, behold, the fire draws near me." The angel answered, "That which you did not kindle shall not burn you, for though this appears to be a terrible and great fire, yet it tries every man according to the merits of his work, for every man's concupiscence shall burn in the fire, for as everyone burns in the body through unlawful pleasure, so when discharged of the body, he shall burn in the punishment which he has deserved." Then he saw one of the three angels, who had been his conductors throughout both visions, go before and divide the flame of fire, whilst the other two, flying about on both sides, defended him from the danger of that fire. He also saw devils flying through the fire, raising conflagrations of wars against the just. Then followed accusations of the wicked spirits against him, the defense of the good angels in his favor, and a more extended view of the heavenly troops, as also of holy men of his own nation, whom he had long since been informed to have been deservedly advanced to the degree of priesthood, from whom he heard many things that might be very salutary to himself, or to all others that would listen to them. When they had ended their discourse and returned to heaven with the angelic spirits, the three angels remained with blessed Firzi, of whom we have spoken before, and who were to bring him back to his body. And when they approached the aforesaid immense fire, the angel divided the flame as he had done before. But when the man of God came to the passage so opened amidst the flames, the unclean spirits, laying hold of one of those whom they tormented in the fire, threw him at him, and touching his shoulder and jaw, burned them. He knew the man, and called to mind that he had received his garment when he had died. And the angel, immediately laying hold, threw him back into the fire. And the malignant enemy said, "Do not reject him whom you before received, for as you accepted the goods of him who was a sinner, so you must partake of his punishment." The angel replying said, "He did not receive the same through avarice, but in order to save his soul." The fire ceased, and the angel, turning to him, added, "That which you kindled burned in you. For had you not received the money of this person that died in his sins, his punishment would not burn in you." And proceeding in his discourse, He gave him wholesome advice for what ought to be done towards the salvation of such as repented. Being afterwards restored to his body, throughout the whole course of his life, he bore the mark of the fire which he had felt in his soul, visible to all men on his shoulder and jaw, and the flesh publicly showed, in a wonderful manner, what the soul had suffered in private. He always took care, as he had done before, to persuade all men to the practice of virtue, as well by his example as by preaching. But as for the matter of his visions, he would only relate them to those who, from holy zeal and desire for reformation, wished to learn the same. An ancient brother of our monastery is still living, who is wont to declare that a very sincere and religious man told him that he had seen Fursey himself in the province of the East Angles, and heard those visions from his mouth, adding that though it was in most sharp winter weather and a hard frost, and the man was sitting in a thin garment when he related it, yet he sweated as if it had been in the greatest heat of summer, either through excessive fear or spiritual consolation. To return to what we were saying before, when, after preaching the word of God many years in Scotland, he could no longer bear the crowds that resorted to him, leaving all that he seemed to possess, he departed from his native island and came with a few brothers through the Britons into the province of the English, and, preaching the word of God there, as has been said, built a noble monastery. These things being rightly performed, he became desirous to rid himself of all business of this world, and even of the monastery itself, and forthwith left the same and the care of souls to his brother Fullen and the priests Gobbin and Dickle, and being himself free from all that was worldly, resolved to end his life as a hermit. He had another brother called Ultan, who, after a long monastical probation, had also adopted the life of an anchorite. Repairing all alone to him, he lived a whole year with him in continence and prayer, and labored daily with his hands. Afterwards, seeing the province in confusion by the eruptions of the pagans, and presaging that the monasteries would be also in danger, he left all things in order and sailed over into France, and being there honorably entertained by Clovis, king of the Franks, or by the patrician Erkenwald, he built a monastery in the place called Litiniacum, and falling sick not long after, departed this life. The same Erkenwald took his body and deposited it in the porch of a church he was building in his town of Peronne, till the church itself should be dedicated. This happened 27 days after, and the body being taken from the porch to be reburied near the altar, was found as entire as if he had just then died. And again, 4 years after, a more decent tabernacle or chapel being built for the same body to the eastward of the altar, it was still found free from corruption, and translated thither with due honor, where it is well known that his merits, through the divine operation, have been declared by many miracles. These things, and the incorruption of his body, we have taken notice of, that the sublimeness of this man may be the better known to the readers. All which, whosoever will read it, will find more fully described, as also about his fellow laborers, in the book of his life before mentioned. So, there you have the visions of St. Fursa as preserved by Bede. One rather distinctly medieval feature of this afterlife vision is how it has a lasting physical effect on the person, or two effects in this case. First, his body miraculously bears the burn scars that his spiritual self received, something we saw a version of in episode 49 concerning a medieval Marley's ghost, when the ghost gives his old friend a small, caustic sample of the pains of hell that leaves his flesh scarred. These scars are a kind of early anticipation of stigmata, which first appears with accounts of St. Francis centuries later in the 1200s. Secondly, we have a physical reaction to the mere memory of the experience, in this case, Fursa's profuse sweating as he retells the vision. Keep an eye out for this motif in our next vision. From what I've read, this is not a feature of modern Western near-death experiences, this physicalized proof, but if we take one step back into a broader category of any tokens of proof that the experience was supernatural, then we do still find this as a feature that pops up in modern accounts, usually in the form of the out-of-body part of the experience, allowing the person to see or hear something nearby that they shouldn't have been able to perceive. These are the things that are most frequently touted as proof of the existence of a soul. The skeptics who have researched this find that typically the quality and specificity of the proof gets exaggerated in retellings, and some of the most famous examples are quite poorly documented or substantiated, so I'll just leave that caveat there. Looking beyond just the near-death aspects of this narrative, we also have an interesting little bit of theology in the vision, when Fursa is told that he must suffer for the sins of the person that he received clothing from, that the original owner got the garment through the sin of avarice, and thus Fursa is benefiting materially from that sinful act and thus must pay penance for it too. At least, that's how I understand it. There's some ambiguous messaging there, where the angels emphasize that you won't burn for sins that you did not kindle within yourself, but accepting the garment of the greedy man did count as kindling. The exact nature of Fursa's sinfulness there is rather unclear to me. Anyway, I suspect this is a pretty alien concept to most American Christian conceptions of sin, at least where I think most rugged individualists would recoil at the idea that you could be held responsible for someone else's sins. But a version of this idea is gaining ground secularly, in the form of these crises of conscience over the actions of one's employer or the causes they funnel money to. To what degree do you take on some responsibility for C-suite actions that you have no say in, but which your labor helps create the resources for? Or, all of us face this in deciding what companies and services to patronize, whether we're buying things from them directly or giving them the valuable commodity of our data or our value as targets of advertising. Regardless of our own personal virtue, how much guilt do we bear for the unvirtuous actions of others enabled or financed by our choices? Once again, a medieval example finds some modern currency. Now, back to the near-death of it all. In the canon of near-death experiences, Bede's version here is further away from the conventional narrative features of modern counterparts and heavily indebted to the biblical visions of the prophets. It still has the out-of-body experience element, a looking back down upon the world left behind, albeit in this case from a cosmic distance. There's an experience of one's life being reviewed and judged, and the presence of guiding intelligences, both benevolent and sinister. But Bede renders all this in a way that heightens an abstract and allegorical feel to the experience, despite Fursa's physical scars. And that distances it from the feelings of the individual eyewitness account that your more classic form of near-death experience has. And in that cosmic view of the flames of sin that are threatening to consume the world, Fursa's vision has that prophetic quality of being a message not individually for him, or as we sometimes have in other medieval visions of hellfire, warnings for other specific individuals in the visionary's community, but rather, this is a warning for the whole world. And maybe this is due to Bede's use of a written source for much of his information. The details of the vision have already been refracted through a literary and didactic mode, a scripturally influenced mode. And it's telling that the most concrete feeling bit of the story, to me at least, the detail of Fursa sweating through the remembering of his experience, comes from the personal account of one of Bede's fellow monks, albeit relaying what an older monk had passed on to him. Our next account originates with Bede, at least its written form does, and appears to be derived entirely from the living memory of clerics who knew the person in question, which places the events in the mid to late 7th century. And I think it's a little shaggier, a little less refined and coherent in its details, and perhaps a teensy bit closer to a real person's memory of a real experience. Maybe. Or maybe Bede is just very good at creating that effect. Either way, here is the vision of Drichthelm, also from the Historia Ecclesiastica, Book 5, Chapter 12, as translated by J.A. Giles. At this time, a memorable miracle, and like to those of former days, was wrought in Britain. For, to the end that the living might be saved from the death of the soul, a certain person, who had been some time dead, rose again to life, and related many remarkable things he had seen, some of which I have thought fit here, briefly, to take notice of. There was a master of a family in that district of the Northumbrians, which is called Cunningham, who led a religious life, as did also all that belonged to him. This man fell sick, and his distemper daily increasing, being brought to extremity, he died in the beginning of the night. But, in the morning early, he suddenly came to life again, and sat up, upon which all those that sat about the body weeping fled away in a great fright. Only his wife, who loved him best, though in a great consternation and trembling, remained with him. He, comforting her, said, "Fear not, for I am now truly risen from death, and permitted again to live among men. However, I am not to live hereafter as I was wont, but from henceforward after a very different manner." Then, rising immediately, he repaired to the oratory of the little town, and continuing in prayer till day, immediately divided all his substance into three parts, one whereof he gave to his wife, another to his children, and the third, belonging to himself, he instantly distributed among the poor. Not long after, he repaired to the monastery of Melrose, which is almost enclosed by the winding of the River Tweed, and having been shaven, went into a private dwelling which the abbot had provided, where he continued till the day of his death, in such extraordinary contrition of mind and body that, though his tongue had been silent, his life declared that he had seen many things either to be dreaded or coveted, which others knew nothing of. Thus he related what he had seen. "He that led me had a shining countenance and a bright garment, and we went on silently, as I thought, towards the northeast. Walking on, we came to a vale of great breadth and depth, but of infinite length. On the left it appeared full of dreadful flames. The other side was no less horrid, for violent hail and cold snow flying in all directions. Both places were full of men's souls, which seemed by turns to be tossed from one side to the other, as it were by a violent storm. For when the wretches could no longer endure the excess of heat, they leapt into the middle of the cutting cold, and finding no rest there, they leapt back again into the middle of the unquenchable flames. Now, whereas an innumerable multitude of deformed souls were thus alternately tormented far and near, as far as could be seen, without any intermission, I began to think that this perhaps might be hell, of whose intolerable flames I had often heard talk. My guide, who went before me, answered to my thought, saying, 'Do not believe so, for this is not the hell you imagine.' When he had conducted me, much frightened with that horrid spectacle, by degrees to the farther end, on a sudden I saw the place begin to grow dusk and filled with darkness. When I came into it, the darkness by degrees grew so thick that I could see nothing besides it and the shape and garment of him that led me. As we went on through the shades of night, on a sudden there appeared before us frequent globes of black flames, rising as it were out of a great pit and falling back again into the same. When I had been conducted thither, my leader suddenly vanished and left me alone in the midst of darkness and this horrid vision, whilst those same globes of fire, without intermission, at one time flew up and at another fell back into the bottom of the abyss. And I observed that all the flames, as they ascended, were full of human souls, which, like sparks flying up with smoke, were sometimes thrown on high and again, when the vapor of the fire ceased, dropped down into the depth below. Moreover, an insufferable stench came forth with the vapors and filled all those dark places. Having stood there a long time in much dread, not knowing what to do, which way to turn, or what end I might expect, on a sudden I heard behind me the noise of a most hideous and wretched lamentation, and at the same time a loud laughing, as of a rude multitude insulting captured enemies. When that noise, growing plainer, came up to me, I observed a gang of evil spirits dragging the howling and lamenting souls of men into the midst of the darkness, whilst they themselves laughed and rejoiced. Among those men, as I could discern, There was one shorn like a clergyman, a layman, and a woman. The evil spirits that dragged them went down into the midst of the burning pit, and as they went down deeper, I could no longer distinguish between the lamentation of the men and the laughing of the devils. Yet, I still had a confused sound in my ears. In the meantime, some of the dark spirits ascended from that flaming abyss, and running forward, beset me on all sides, and much perplexed me with their glaring eyes and the stinking fire which proceeded from their mouths and nostrils, and threatened to lay hold on me with burning tongs which they had in their hands. Yet they durst not touch me, though they frightened me. Being thus on all sides enclosed with enemies and darkness, and looking about on every side for assistance, there appeared behind me, on the way that I came, as it were, the brightness of a star shining amidst the darkness, which increased by degrees and came rapidly towards me. When it drew near, all those evil spirits that sought to carry me away with their tongs dispersed and fled. He, whose approach put them to flight, was the same that had led me before, who, then turning towards the right, began to lead me, as it were, towards the southeast, and having soon brought me out of the darkness, conducted me into an atmosphere of clear light. While he thus led me in open light, I saw a vast wall before us, the length and height of which, in every direction, seemed to be altogether boundless. I began to wonder why we went up to the wall, seeing no door, window, or path through it. When we came to the wall, we were presently, I know not by what means, on the top of it, and within it was a vast and delightful field, so full of fragrant flowers that the odor of its delightful sweetness immediately dispelled the stink of the dark furnace which had pierced me through and through. So great was the light in this place that it seemed to exceed the brightness of the day or the sun in its meridian height. In this field were innumerable assemblies of men in white and many companies seated together rejoicing. As he led me through the midst of those happy inhabitants, I began to think that this might, perhaps, be the kingdom of heaven, of which I had often heard so much. He answered to my thought, saying, "This is not the kingdom of heaven, as you imagine." When we had passed those mansions of blessed souls and gone farther on, I discovered before me a much more beautiful light, and therein heard sweet voices of persons singing, and so wonderful a fragrancy proceeded from the place, that the other which I had before thought most delicious, then seemed to me but very indifferent, even as that extraordinary brightness of the flowery field, compared with this, appeared mean and inconsiderable. When I began to hope we should enter that delightful place, my guide, on a sudden, stood still, and then, turning back, led me back by the way we came. When we returned to those joyful mansions of the souls in white, he said to me, "Do you know what all these things are which you have seen?" I answered I did not, and then he replied, "That veil you saw, so dreadful for consuming flames and cutting cold, is the place in which the souls of those are tried and punished who, delaying to confess and amend their crimes, at length have recourse to repentance at the point of death, and so depart this life, but nevertheless, because they, even at their death, confessed and repented, they shall all be received into the kingdom of heaven at the day of judgment. But many are relieved before the day of judgment, by the prayers, alms, and fasting of the living, and more especially by masses. That fiery and stinking pit which you saw is the mouth of hell, into which whosoever falls shall never be delivered to all eternity. This flowery place in which you see these most beautiful young people, so bright and merry, is that into which the souls of those are received who depart the body in good works, but who are not so perfect as to deserve to be immediately admitted into the kingdom of heaven. Yet they shall all, at the day of judgment, see Christ and partake of the joys of his kingdom, for whoever are perfect in thought, word, and deed, as soon as they depart the body, immediately enter into the kingdom of heaven. In the neighborhood whereof that place is where you heard the sound of sweet singing with the fragrant odor and bright light. As for you, who are now to return to your body and live among men again, if you will endeavor nicely to examine your actions and direct your speech and behavior in righteousness and simplicity, you shall, after death, have a place of residence among these joyful troops of blessed souls. For when I left you for a while, it was to know how you were to be disposed of." When he had said this to me, I much abhorred returning to my body, being delighted with the sweetness and beauty of the place I beheld, and with the company of those I saw in it. However, I durst not ask him any questions, but in the meantime, on a sudden, I found myself alive among men. Now, these and other things which this man of God saw, he would not relate to slothful persons and such as lived negligently, but only to those who, being terrified with the dread of torments, or delighted with the hopes of heavenly joys, would make use of his words to advance in piety. In the neighborhood of his cell lived one Hemgils, a monk, eminent in the priesthood, which he honored by his good works. He is still living and leading a solitary life in Ireland, supporting his declining age with coarse bread and cold water. He often went to that man, and asking several questions, heard of him all the particulars of what he had seen when separated from his body, by whose relation we also came to the knowledge of those few particulars which we have briefly set down. He also related his visions to King Alfred, a man most learned in all respects, and was by him so willingly and attentively heard that at his request he was admitted into the monastery above mentioned and received the monastic tonsure. And the said king, when he happened to be in those parts, very often went to hear him. At that time the religious and humble abbot and priest Ethelwald presided over the monastery, and now, with worthy conduct, possesses the episcopal see of the Church of Lindisfarne. He had a more private place of residence assigned him in that monastery, where he might apply himself to the service of his Creator in continual prayer. And, as that place lay on the bank of the river, he was wont often to go into the same to do penance in his body, and many times to dip quite under the water, and to continue saying psalms or prayers in the same as long as he could endure it, standing still sometimes up to the middle, and sometimes up to the neck in water. And when he went out from thence ashore, he never took off his cold and frozen garments till they grew warm and dry on his body. And when in winter the half-broken pieces of ice were swimming about him, which he himself had broken to make room to stand or dip himself in the river, those who beheld it would say, "It is wonderful, Brother Drichthelm," for so he was called, "that you are able to endure such violent cold." He simply answered, for he was a man of much simplicity and indifferent wit, "I have seen greater cold." And when they said, "It is strange that you will endure such austerity," he replied, "I have seen more austerity." Thus he continued, through an indefatigable desire of heavenly bliss, to subdue his aged body with daily fasting till the day of his being called away, and he forwarded the salvation of many by his words and example. So, there you have the famous vision of Drichthelm. Though Bede suggests that the story was already well known in his time, his is the earliest surviving written version. About a century later, Alcuin of York would take Bede's text and make a fairly direct versification of it, including it in his Bishops, Kings, and Saints of York, and then, around the year 1000, Alfric of Ensham translated Bede's Latin text into Old English, and later writers continued to cite it specifically for its details of purgatorial punishments. And by promulgating these two visions in particular, Fursa's and Drichthelm's, Bede became a significant figure for lending authority to the idea that souls of the dead undergo penitential punishments in preparation for entering the kingdom of heaven, though it wouldn't be until the late 1100s when the conception of purgatory as a distinct location within the geography of the afterlife really crystallized. And then, of course, it later decrystallized in Catholic orthodoxy to be more a state of spiritual being rather than a place for a spirit to go. But let's look at some of the details of Drichthelm's vision. Bede has rendered it as Drichthelm's own first-person narration, though we should take this as rhetorical license and not any claim to be representing his exact words. That said, one of the details I find most intriguing makes the most sense as something carried over from the original witness. This is when Drichthelm comments that he and his guide were approaching a great wall, and then he found himself, quote, "I know not by what means, on the top of it," end quote. That is such a lovely little naturalistic representation of dream experience. We were opening Christmas presents in our living room, but then somehow it was also my 10th grade English class. In dreams, you often have these transitions of scene and even characters without an awareness of the transition. You just become aware of the fact that you're no longer where you had been, or feel like you're in the same conversation, but now you're talking to a different person than you started with. So this singular moment stands out as something we might expect to find in an authentic recollection of a near-death experience, which, big surprise, often have very dream-like features. But this cut to the top of the wall could also be the invention of an author who knows the main sequence of images from the vision, but hasn't been told the details of how the soul and its guide got from one location to the next. However, especially compared to the less personal-feeling visions of Fursa, this does better fit the common patterns of that putatively universal near-death experience. We do skip over the actual leaving of the physical body, starting the recollection with Drichthelm already with his guide, walking, as he says, towards the northeast. This guide never acquires an individual identity. It's not clear if it's a saint or an angel, but it is a figure that clearly belongs in this environment and makes the traveler feel more secure. One might well ask how Drichthelm knows they're heading northeast. Presumably, he would be judging by the location of the sun, though that implies that wherever they are still under the sun. Which is not out of bounds, as in the early Middle Ages especially, there were still notions floating around of the entryways to at least hell and an earthly paradise being located on Earth, as we saw last episode with the voyage of the Ikora. It's also possible that Bede has filled in this detail based on a conventional understanding that Christ's seat lay in the east and Satan's domain was found to the north. So the journey northward takes them towards the gates of hell, and when they later turn to the southeast, they approach the kingdom of heaven. Speaking of the guide, I like how we get an early example of the classic cave guide trick of turning the lights off on the tourists, when the bright shining guide just vanishes and leaves Drichthelm alone in the unfathomable, demon-haunted darkness. I'm not aware of a parallel in modern near-death experiences, but the motif of being temporarily abandoned by the guide occurs in several medieval afterlife visions, quite possibly because they have been modeled on the very popular and paradynamic vision of Drichthelm. In terms of the language of the vision, both visions actually, Bede describes both the evil spirits and the human souls encountered in the other world with the Latin term spiritus. Semantically at least, there is no obvious division between souls and devils here. In the 8th century, we are still early days in the development of an understanding of the mechanics of the afterlife, and this ambiguity continues in some uncertainty about whether the souls in hell are just eternally stuck in their torment, or if some of them are put to work tormenting each other. We saw this in our Revenants episode as well, this question of whether the wicked could continue to do harm after death, if they might be able to leave hell and come back and afflict the living, or if it's all demons just pretending to be people. Speaking of, we have a callback to episode 3, where Simeon of Durham reported the vision of another man who returned from the dead, who, just like Drichthelm, immediately emphasizes, upon reviving, that he has truly returned from the dead. Which I take to be a reaction either to the fear of revenants reanimated by false spirits, or to fears about necromancy and communication with the dead in ways that fall short of miraculous resuscitation. So, way back at the beginning of this episode, I highlighted how near-death experiences are useful texts to do cross-cultural comparisons with, since presumably they represent fundamentally the same basic physiological experience being refracted through the beliefs, values, and imagery of one person's culture. For example, that life review motif in Christian contexts will typically involve having one's own life flash before your eyes, in modern versions, or in medieval accounts it may be a reading or recitation of deeds, good and bad. But Buddhists, or adherents to certain New Age spiritualities, may report a review of life events that includes events from past lives. The neurologist looks at that and perhaps proposes that the common experience there was just some flash of disconnected sensory impressions, memories, that the perceiving consciousness tries to reorganize into a coherent narrative, and it does that according to its own cultural priming, which is also one theory of what most dreams are, essentially disconnected montages that the waking brain is, after the fact, trying to reconstruct into a narrative. And that allows us to interpret differences in accounts as significant effects of cultural differences. Some such differences are minor, like modern accounts frequently describe passing through a dark tunnel to a place of light. Not so many tunnels in the medieval versions, but often there is a dark valley or veil, so still a narrow, confined passage. And a modern person is much more likely to have traveled through a tunnel or seen that represented on screen than a medieval person was, when transit tunnels would have been a very rare engineering marvel. In this case, there's no grand cultural conclusion to draw other than the reminder that medieval people had a different stock of spatial metaphors to draw on than we do. Rather more open to productive interpretation is the fact that medieval accounts tend to put a great deal more emphasis on the spiritual accounting of sins and good works in these visions than most modern Western accounts, which certainly suggests different conceptions of how authority manifests itself. Which may also be reflected in how medieval spiritual guides are overwhelmingly angels or saints or other impersonal authorities, whereas modern accounts more typically have guides who are figures from the person's life, relatives or friends. Incidentally, not always dead ones. Does this reveal a difference about what is perceived as important, even at the cosmic scale, or who is allowed to be important? Of course, with medieval accounts, we also have to reckon with the potentially manipulative hand of the writer who is preserving the account and almost never the actual experiencer of it. And those authors are certainly going to be invested in aligning the account with the orthodoxy of their era to some degree or another. Maybe Drichtelm did say his guide was his late uncle, but Hemgils, who passed the story on to Bede, was a local and knew that Drichtelm's actual uncle did not exactly have a spotless reputation around town and decided to edit that detail out as unsuitable. Fortunately, there is an approach you can take to interpreting these narratives that kind of solves for that sort of distortion. It even solves a bit for leaving the underlying physiological process of near-death experiences a mystery. And this is to focus less on how these narratives come to be, and more on how they are received and utilized by others. I came across a 2018 article by Claire White, Michael Kinsella, and Jesse Baring called How to Know You've Survived Death, a Cognitive Account of the Popularity of Contemporary Postmortem Survival Narratives. We're near the end of an already very long episode, so I won't go into detail about the argument of this article, though it is pretty interesting. Short form. As the title suggests, their approach is to look for how human cognitive processes and predispositions shape religious belief. This is the cognitive science of religion. But they aren't trying to explain how the life review is a product of lack of oxygen to the amygdala or what have you. It's not about the neurology of the near-death brain. Instead, they basically start with the question, why are near-death experiences so popular and so widely shared? And is it something about how we think that not only gives them their common features, but makes them so attractive? The cognitive principle they go to is called simulation constraint. In other words, the limits of imagination. Quote, in the context of thinking about what the afterlife is like, this refers to the inability to conceive of ourselves as being dead and unconscious because we use mental states to simulate all experiences. This imaginative obstacle means that it is easier to represent your dead self, and correspondingly dead others, as continuing to exist mentally, just elsewhere, whether in a different body or a different realm. End quote. And thus, the thing that is attractive about near-death narratives is how they represent personal survival, the survival of a recognizable individual consciousness, even across multiple lives in the case of near-death experiences featuring reincarnation and past lives. And they note how this shows up in unusual, and I might add distinctly dreamlike, features of some near-death experiences, such as where a figure is recognized as definitely being someone the dying person knows, even though they do not have the appearance of that person. The experiencer says, "They didn't look like my grandmother, but somehow I just knew it was my grandmother." A similar thing appears in some medieval miracle accounts, especially for child saints, where the dead saint makes an appearance in an adult form, and the witness explains that they just knew it was the saint in spiritual form, even though they never looked that way in life. White, Kinsella, and Baring argue that featuring such characters in the narrative reinforces personal survival. It applies not just to you, but to other minds as well. Implicit in this is the belief, or we might say cognitive working assumption, that consciousness can exist separate from the body. Note the common feature in these narratives of the person leaving their body behind. Something we don't usually see in the medieval accounts, interestingly. They may well say that their soul left their body, but they don't usually describe seeing the people gathered around their deathbed as their soul departs. Usually we just have one of those jump cuts to an otherworld environment. An interesting division is between people who describe their experience as remaining disembodied versus those who report going on to inhabit a new body, even if it's a spiritual body. Among American near-death experiences, it appears to be roughly 50-50, with a slight majority reporting the experience of having a body on the other side. White, Kinsella, and Baring argue that this shows a cognitive predisposition for humans to perceive ourselves as inhabiting our bodies rather than being our bodies. Our medieval examples are an interesting case there, inasmuch as while they fundamentally agree with that proposition, the depictions are very much the soul venturing out from the body and having an individual experience. But having the soul bring back physical scars to the body suggests a greater entanglement of soul and body than is perhaps reflected in modern narratives, and which fits in with Orthodox Last Judgment resurrection theology, even several centuries before the scholastics had sorted out all the specifics about how that's supposed to work. And if you're curious, check out our episode 43 concerning the resurrection of cannibals for more on that. And I think the medieval examples help support this cognitive argument inasmuch as they reflect the same core narrative features even against some of the dominant theological motifs. Now, I won't say that medieval theology didn't believe in personal, individual survival. They didn't believe in an oversoul, for example. But there is certainly a kind of lack of emphasis on individuality in the afterlife in the standard theology. It's one of the well-observed features of the narrative technique of hagiography, that it tends towards the erosion of the individuality of saints, and ultimately fits them all into the same template. When they have a very distinct portfolio or presence, it's usually less about them as individuals, and more them as members and epitomes of their community, especially in the earlier Middle Ages. Anyway, my point is that medieval depictions of the blessed or the damned, even in near-death visions, are of practically faceless masses, be they in bliss or in torment. And yet, the key thing is that the near-death narrative still fixates on the first person I. I saw it, I smelled it, I felt it, I was there. I wanted to join the one multitude and save myself from the other. Medievalist Andrew Rabin has highlighted how Bede presents Drichtelm's vision in first-person narration, the longest speech by anyone other than Bede in the whole of the Historia Ecclesiastica. Rabin makes some very interesting points about how Bede does this to model the conversion power of these stories, to foreground the act of witnessing, both by the original experiencer and then again by each new audience for that testimony that has to interrogate it, interpret it, and internalize it. But I think the cognitive science approach also reinforces why Bede and Bede's audience would find the first-person nature attractive. And it's because, maybe especially if your afterlife is a little bit devoid of individuality, representing the individual experience suits our imaginations. There's also probably something in there about negativity bias and why the torments of hell tend to be so much more vividly described than the pleasures of heaven, but that's something we might pick up next time as we continue to explore some early medieval visions of hell. Of course, Bede's version of the visions of Fursa is third person, so there's a counterexample, though I think Fursa is handled differently primarily because Bede is drawing from an existing written source that he repeatedly invokes, so he may feel less liberty to play around with the point of view. And we will see more first-person narration of hellscapes from Bede in our next episode, so tune back in for that. Our riddle today is another of the riddles of Symphosius. It goes, as translated by Elizabeth Hickman Dubois, "A bristly mother gave me birth, they say, and now above my verdant food I stay. My name, too, is a god's, with the first sound away." If you have a little familiarity with conventional animal descriptions of the late classical and medieval periods, you could probably get this one from its first line, "A bristly mother gave me birth." If you're going to encounter a bristly animal in the Middle Ages, there's a good chance it's a boar or pig. And that is the answer here. But the thing that locks in the answer is a bit of Latin wordplay from the last line. How does a pig have a god's name with the first sound removed? Well, Latin for pig is porcus. Remove the P and you have Orcus, the Roman god of the underworld. But one of them anyway. Incidentally, there is apparently a book from 1952 by the art historian Richard Bernheimer called Wild Men in the Middle Ages that, at least per Wikipedia, argues that the cult of Orcus persisted in rural areas well after the decline of the rest of the Roman pantheon, and that it morphed into the wild man figure of the Middle Ages. I haven't read that, and I don't know how well that argument holds up in the light of more current scholarship, but it sounds interesting. Very mid-century anthropology, but still intriguing. If you're interested in checking out any of the sources I used for this episode, you can find full bibliographic references on our website, medievaldeathtrip.com, with links to the stuff that's available digitally. You can also contact me there by email to patrick@medievaldeathtrip.com, or find links to the current batch of social media platforms we're on. I'll just mention that right now, Instagram is the most reliable way to actually interact with me on social media, since it's the social app on my phone that seems to not keep losing its notification settings for whatever reason. You can also support the show through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/mdtpodcast. Our supporters get access to bonus audio content. For example, this episode was originally going to be considerably longer, with a whole section on structuralism and the history of the problem of making cross-cultural comparisons, which I cut out of the script, but will record as an appendix for those patrons who might be interested in a little history of scholarly movements. Since last episode, one patron has joined us, so thank you so much, Matt, for your support. It is greatly appreciated, as is the support of everyone who contributes through Patreon. Until next time, just be careful about who you inherit garments from, and do a little detective work if you're thrifting, lest you kindle something you weren't expecting. And thanks for listening.